offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, this is Prem, and with me is Arvind. And we are here to continue our discussion on this beautiful work, a compilation of conversations with Swami, compiled by one of the eminent devotees of Swami, Dr. John Hislop from United States. And very interesting themes are being discussed here. The last time around when we were discussing, that is the last week, there was this question about the epics, Mahabharata and Ramayana, and Swami spoke of how they are indeed historical by nature, but at the same time, they do not benefit us merely as stories, and one has to go to the inner significance. But at the same time, that doesn't take away from the fact that they are occurrences in our in Indian history. And Swami was speaking about that. And then there was this question of Hislop asking Swami about Arjuna's reaction when Krishna chooses to withdraw from the physical realm. And he said that's something that always confounded him. He says someone who's been so close to Krishna, somebody who has in fact even witnessed the Vishwarupa, how does he get so affected when the Lord merely withdraws from the physical? And Swami explained, and especially the events that happen after that, when he's not able to fend off evil forces in trying to protect the Gopikas, and the stories which you've read in Bhagavad Vaini. And Swami says that that is one of the problems when somebody is gives a lot of importance to the physical presence of the Lord. And we discussed about that. And then there was a comparison between that and the reaction of the Gopikas. And Swami was saying that they also chose to react in a manner which probably Swami would not approve us reacting. That is, they all, many of them even gave up their life. But Swami said that their only attachment to the physical was because the Lord was in the physical realm. And when they heard that Krishna was no more there, it was a very natural thing for them to lose every kind of attachment towards the physical. And it was not a conscious choice to put an end to one's life, but it was the Jivatma automatically detaching itself from the body and the physical world. So that was the point where we stopped, and there are some very interesting topics that are going to be discussed today too. But before that, let's ask Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. We shall continue with the conversations with Sai, and today also, as always, it gets interesting and intriguing, and the themes that are being discussed can possibly be classified as practical themes, because these are questions that arise in most of our minds as we take up to the spiritual path, or even if we don't take up to the spiritual path. Because the next question that Hislop asks is, might an avatar be born in some other part of the world? Because the concept of avatarhood possibly exists only in India, in the Bharata Varsha, only in the Sanatana Dharma. So he's asking that, is it possible that an avatar is born in some other part of the world? Because if that happens, then the avatar would not be as such physically belonging to the Sanatana Dharma. And Swami replies, Buddha, Christ, Muhammad and others were not avatars. They had some divine power. Only in India are avatars born, because only in India are the Shastras understood. And only in India do the sages constantly experiment and practice. It is like in a gold mine. Where gold is found, there gather the geologists, engineers and experienced miners. The gold is mined there and then it is taken all over the world. It's very evident that India is the gold mine which was going to provide gold to the rest of the world. Well, that statement holds true even in a literal sense, because it is said that even as late as 1600s and 1700s, there was so much gold in India. Even to this day, in 2020, people speak about the amount of gold that exists in India. If you manage to add up the gold lying with each and every household in every part of India, mm-hmm. it will easily beat the amount of gold in possibly the legendary Fort Knox of the United States, because that is the amount of gold. So in a literal sense, also that is true. that India is the gold mine. But it is definitely 100% very true from a spiritual sense, because Swami says that it is only in India that avatars take birth. So, you know, even when we look at the others, like Swami mentions Buddha, Christ, Muhammad, even Buddha and Christ, they lived in India for a very good part of their lives. There are in fact a couple of books on how Jesus visited India. So before he became the messenger of God, the Son of God, and finally realized his oneness with the God Almighty, he was there. Don't know what he was doing, but it is purported that he did a lot of penance in India. Gautam Buddha, well, he was born in Kapilavastu, which lies in present-day Nepal. Possibly that was also part of India, the Bharat Varsha in those days. But he definitely attained Nirvana at Bodh Gaya, which is very much in India even to this day. And then he first taught at Sarnath. So these are the places that are held very, very special and very holy for the Buddhists. And like how we have Chardham in the Sanatana Dharma, Badrinath, Kedarnath, Gangotri and Yamunotri, they too have a kind of a Chardham, the four pilgrimage places that they must visit. And those four are these: Kapilavastu, Sarnath, Bodh Gaya, and I think there's one more place called Kushinagar. So Kushinagar is the place where the ashes of the Buddha are supposed to be there. All of these are in India. Sarnath, the place where he first taught, where he first delivered his discourse on Dhamma. Dhamma is the Buddhist word for Dharma. It's hardly 10 kilometers away from Varanasi, which is the epicenter for the Sanatana Dharma, Banaras. So one thing is absolutely clear, that the avatars take place only in India, and even non-avatars, spiritual beings who are enlightened beings who come to uplift the humanity, uplift the world, have some kind of, you know, magical or intimate connection with this land of India.
Right. In fact, even as you're talking about Sarnath, Sarnath is the place where that episode of Professor Kasturi seeking a mantra actually happened.
Aha, okay.
He was at Sarnath, and that's why he felt that it is even more significant that if he could get a mantra here, because it was the land where the Buddha gave his first sermon.
Oh, that's interesting, because we usually hear it as
actually, as Swami Kashi. Was visiting Kashi, and on that particular day, Swami had gone to Sarnath. And
I didn't know that Swami has been to Sarnath.
Right, and he had maintained a fast for the whole day, hoping that on that day Swami will give. You know, it's a nice diary entry that way, right? But what Swami is saying is very significant. I think there are some other discourses where Swami has said this. You know, there are two ways of looking at it. Why does the avatar take place in India? Swami would say that there is a need, there is a craving here. That is one thing. But at the same time, Swami would say, you know, where would you put your sapling if you wanted to grow? You put it where the environment is suitable, where there are people who are ready to accept and let that sapling flourish.
The soil is fertile.
The soil is fertile there. And Swami would say that is perfectly available in the Indian subcontinent. In fact, if I'm not wrong, it is again a Samako's discourse where Swami speaks of what are the three fundamental pillars of Sanatan Dharma. And Swami says, if you believe in these three, only then you can call yourself a Hindu. Right? You know, we often wonder, what is it to be a Hindu? Or what is it to be a person who says, I believe in Sanatan Dharma? So we said those three things are: one is the theory of karma, that whatever you do has a consequence. The other is that you're a jivatma which travels from different bodies, which means there's
rebirth.
And the third is that the Lord comes down as an avatar.
The concept of avatarhood.
Swami said, in this land, people are mentally prepared for that. And as Swami says in the Bhagavad Vaini also, one of the main reasons why the Lord comes down in a human form is to satisfy the cravings of the devotees. You know? And Swami would say that, you know, for the craving to be there, you need to have an acceptance of the concept itself, that God can come in a human form, and I want to have that kind of a communion with the Lord. So Swami says all of this is suitable in this land, but at the same time, Swami would say it does not confine the avatar only to India or this region. So he says this is definitely the fertile land, but the fruit that comes from the tree can be eaten by anybody, can be eaten even by the person who comes from a desert. So Swami says the avatar is universal, but the most fertile acceptance is available in the Bharatvarsha.
You know, on a slightly lighter vein, even if we look at it physically, I think if the avatar chose to be born in any other country, possibly the world will not benefit, because as you said, there are no sufficient people who have faith in the concept, in these three concepts of karma, reincarnation and the incarnation of God, which is avatarhood, since they don't believe. And in fact, in many parts of the world, they actively fight it, you know, they negate it, they say it is not possible, you know, life after death is nonsense, it's considered something terrible to say. So in such circumstances, I don't think the avatar would even get recognized. Even if the avatar has come and gone, we don't know of it today because it's not recognized. And the other point is, you know, India being such a populous country, I think there's a maximum scope of maximum benefit being achieved.
True.
The other country, of course, is China, but as of now, it is.
No, whatever be the reason, many times when we were students, we used to wonder, when we look at so many of these devotees coming from very distant lands, we used to tell ourselves, imagine if the avatar had taken place in some Bolivia or Belgium.
Would we have gone?
Know, would we have taken the trouble to put all our lives' earnings and go and see the avatar? You know, I mean, we look at so many foreigners here, Westerners, who, it's not an easy thing to come all the way.
And that is why I think, you know, I remember in an interview before an Independence Day drama that we were doing, Swami clearly defined who is a Bharatiya. See, we often translate Bharat as India, and that's what Hislop has done here as well. That is why we are saying India. But Swami had a different definition. He would always refer to it as Bharat. Swami never says India in his discourses. He always says Bharata Mata, Bharata Putrudu, Bharat. And in that interview, Swami said, Bha stands for Bhagwan and Rati. Rati is one who has intense love.
Attachment and love.
Attachment and love, yes. So Swami said, anyone who has that intense attachment and love for God is a Bharatiya. Because, like going by what you said before, once they have that yearning only, will you be able to recognize the avatar. So it is not about living within the geographical confines of India, but it's about having that intense longing and desire for God. And I think that is how all the people that you referred to, who travel from long distances and come, they qualify to be Bharatiyas because they have that yearning and longing for God.
In fact, you know, even as we are speaking, there is an article which is being prepared for being published in on the Radio Sai website. So maybe, dear listeners, tomorrow if you see, you should be able to find it. It's a very interesting article of Swami narrating the story of a devotee. Mm-hmm. And it was narrated by Mr. T.G. Krishnamurthy, the former state president of Tamil Nadu. And this happened in Sundaram. Swami was in Sundaram. Swami's abode in Chennai. And a few of these people, a couple of them were former state presidents. And Mr. T.G.K. was one of the younger people then. So he was also in the audience. And Swami called all of them. But Swami had in his hand a rosary which he was holding. So they thought maybe Swami is going to give it to one of us. And then Swami looked at the three or four people there and asked, do you know what this is? So they said, Swami, it is a Japamala. Swami said, it's not a regular Japamala, what is it? And then somebody said, Swami, it is a Spatikamala, that, you know, it's made of a certain
crystal,
because it was not Rudraksha. And so he said, Swami, it's a Spatikamala. But it was a little pinkish. So Swami said, no, it is not the regular Spatikamala also. So then slowly Mr. T.G.K. said, Swami, it is a rosary which the Christians use, because that used to have that pink thread running through it with glass beads. Swami said, yes, it is a Christian rosary. Right? And then Swami started telling that about the devotee to whom it belonged. So Swami said, I gave it to a devotee. Now it has come back to me. So then they were all very eager to know, Swami, you should tell us about it. And then Swami said, there was this lady who was in France. And Swami said, her name was Michelle. And very devoted lady. She started reading different philosophies. And she got very drawn to Advaita philosophy. So she wanted to come and study Advaita in India. So she came away to Pondicherry, which was a French colony then. Right? And this was like in 1920s.
Oh, Swami is not even...
Right, Swami is not... 1928. So okay, Swami is 2 years old. Okay. So she comes to Pondicherry and she is studying under a guru. And she comes to know that there is some priest in a temple who is giving lectures on Bhagavatam and different stories of the Lord. So she comes to the temple and he happens to be a devotee of Lord Shiva. And he is giving a lecture on Shiva Puranam. So she listens to that whole discourse, which is in Tamil, which she does not understand completely. But Swami says that she heard it in a language she does not understand, but still she was in ecstasy. So she took a vow that she has to learn the language. She goes back to Pondicherry, she learns the language, and then starts reading more about Lord Shiva, keeps coming back to this temple and this priest. And then she becomes like a disciple to that priest. She takes care of all his needs. And Swami says in the process, she becomes a very, very devout Lord Shiva devotee. And in one of the conversations, this priest who had become her guru tells her that one day you'll have the vision of Lord Shiva. Right? And then he eventually takes samadhi and everything. But she's like holding on to that idea that one day he has told me that I'll be able to see Lord Shiva. And she goes back to Pondicherry and then she travels around and then she goes to Kashi. She lives in Kashi for a few years. But then
to catch a glimpse of Lord Shiva.
Right. Somebody tells her that Lord Shiva lives in Kashi. So she goes to Kashi there and, you know, nothing happens. So the yearning is growing. So all this is Swami's narration. So the yearning was growing. And then eventually somebody tells her, why don't you go to Puttaparthi? There's a Sai Baba there. And people say that he is an avatar of Lord Shiva. So then Swami says she came to Parthi and she was here for many months. But she was very disappointed because she was not having the vision of Lord Shiva. So finally it came to a point where she decided to leave or, you know, she was very dejected. So Swami is saying, then I called her for an interview. And in the interview, she said, Swami, I'm very disappointed and all that. And then Swami said, look at me. And when she was sitting down and Swami was standing in front of her, when she looked up, she had the vision of Lord Shiva.
Wow.
Right? And then Swami said, then I gave her this Japmala. I told her, you go back to Pondicherry. You don't have to come here. And you do your Japam. And Swami said, in your last moment, I will come and receive you. So Swami said, 2 days back, she reached me and even the Japmala I gave her has come back to me.
Wow.
So Swami was, I mean, imagine a person who came in 1928, right, when Swami was telling, see, that is the yearning of a devotee. If that kind of a yearning is there, you will be drawn to God and God will be drawn to you.
You know, when you just mentioned this, just yesterday I was reading through some old issues of Sanatana Sarathi, and in the 1960 issue, I read a very interesting incident, very similar to this. That's why I am reminded of it. Professor Kasturi writes that it was the 15th of November 1958.
Okay.
So he says they were seated with, he and I forgot who others, they were seated with Swami inside, and Swami was on the chair, they were seated on the floor. Suddenly Swami looked up as if somebody had called him. Swami said, hey! And just collapsed on the floor. And Swami fell with such a thud. Just imagine you're standing and you just collapse. How it will be. So Swami just collapsed onto the floor and they didn't know what to do. So they just sat. It was 5:20 p.m. and they just waited, because Kasturi writes that is what we know to do. We just wait for Swami to. At 5:40, suddenly a lot of vibhuti began to emanate from Swami's mouth. Swami began to like literally spew out vibhuti. And then Swami got up within minutes after that. He got up, sat on the chair and resumed as if nothing had happened. So now Professor Kasturi was burning with curiosity. So he just told Swami, Swami, can you just tell what happened? And Swami was surprised that Professor Kasturi doesn't know what has happened. It was like that. So he said, didn't you see that vibhuti coming from my mouth? So he said, yes Swami, we all saw, but Swami said, huh? When vibhuti comes from my mouth, that means I have gone to grant somebody their final merger with me. It was almost like Swami telling him that for future reference, keep it in mind. Whenever vibhuti comes, it's for that. So then Swami referred to a certain Dr. Krishna. So Swami says Dr. Krishna, and Professor Kasturi recalls Dr. Krishna as a very good and sincere doctor whose mother accompanied Swami during his, I think 1957, Swami had done a
Vishikesha.
She had accompanied, Dr. Krishna's mother had accompanied, and Swami said her mother, so she was in her final moments, so they're all doing bhajans there, very nice, it's a very vibrant atmosphere, Swami's saying. So I went there, I granted her darshan, and I came back. So that's what happened. And Professor Kasturi records that 15th of November 1960, if I'm remembering right, I don't know if I missed the date, but I think it is 15th of November 1958, he writes that it was a Saturday. And he says that the next Tuesday, when they receive letters, and when he goes and gives the letters to Swami, Swami picks out one letter and gives it to him and says, open that and read it. So when he opens it, it's from Dr. Krishna. And she's writing that, Swami, on Saturday, my mother passed away. Okay. She passed away at 5:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Swami, but she was very happy. Before passing away, she called all of us and told us to do bhajans. So we were doing bhajans. And Swami, the way she expressed in her face, we literally felt your presence there. And we felt that she has reached your lotus feet. Just to convey my gratitude for ever being with us, I am writing this letter. And it was posted on the Sunday with some, I don't know what, at that time speed post or whatever. And it had arrived on Tuesday. So when I read that, I just felt that at least that has been recorded in Sanatana Sarathi. How many such instances may be there that we don't know of where, you know, Swami goes and he doesn't make a big show of the whole thing. Here also, because the way it has been recorded, it becomes very clear that because Kasturi asked and pleaded, Swami let it be known what it is. Otherwise, it's just like business as usual. No wonder Swami says, what is ascharyam for you is sahajam for me. That is the thing, because selflessness and responding to the yearning of a devotee is sahajam. It is his nature to do it. And he does it every time without fail.
Absolutely. But just that, as Swami was telling here, the importance of Bharat and the Lord being born here, it I think also gives the understanding that for those who are born in India, there is that added advantage.
Mm.
If you're born in the right family, born in the right environment, in the right lineage, the acceptance of God becomes very natural. You know, even though many of us would have come to Swami much later as devotees, God was always part of our life. In that sense, we are brought up with that. You know, from
correct.
A very young age, from your 1 year, 2 year, you're taught to worship God. And it is never an idea that you rebel against initially. I mean, it's very difficult if you have to embrace an idea of God and worshiping a form much later. Yes, we all become rebels in between. I think that happens with everyone, that where you start questioning everything. But nevertheless, you have already that foundation has been laid even as one is young.
To put it in other words, I would say that in India, the default mode is belief in God.
Right,
you're
absolutely.
Born with that default mode, whereas in other places, the default mode is different. And so while in cases where default mode is different, they discover God. For us, mostly it's a rediscovery of God when we become rebels. And that is the speciality of India. I think it is understandable. See, every country has a kind of speciality, and India's speciality is in this. I was thinking, like, even if you look at educational universities, we have some excellent educational institutes in the world, the Harvards, the MITs, Cambridge, Oxford, and on par with them, definitely on par with them, we also have the Sri Satsai Institute of Higher Learning. But then we don't produce the kind of intellectual papers or research papers or works or innovations the way the other four institutes are mentioned. But that's because each have their speciality. And as Swami himself said, you know, in the discourse on the 22nd of November 1981, I think this was possibly the first convocation of the Sri Satya Sai University. Means when it got the status of a university. Till then, we just had colleges. So Swami said, students, you are aware that there are now 108 universities in India. This university is the 109th. One more than that traditional total. Lokaha samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all the universities succeed and serve the country well. But this university must be distinct from the rest and attain a unique status. It must be the ideal for others. For this consummation, students, teachers, parents, rulers and the people must cooperate. It's so sweet and, you know, interesting that Swami in his discourse himself is saying that there are 108. Actually, 108 is a very nice number. Why should I make it 109? But we are making it because this is not going to be like any of the existing 108. It's going to be a unique one. In that sense, it's going to be only one such university. And we know today why it is such a university, because the emphasis here, as Swami would say, is always on value-based education, on building the eternal Sanatana Dharma, love for God, not shying away from, you know, proclaiming your love for God, feeling pride in loving God, building your character. Swami has given the motto for the university as the end of education is character. To know that you have been educated, there must be a very strong character. And for a very strong character to exist, in my personal opinion, there's definitely a need for deep love for God. Because, you know, we usually embark on the path of bhakti or jnana or whatever, you know, on the divine path to achieve self-realization, you know, enlightenment. That is the final goal. And later on it's coming where, you know, Swami defines moksha or the ultimate goal as immortality. And again, Swami says, immortality is the removal of immorality. So, removing immorality, inculcating morality, having strong character, this faith and love in God is very, very absolutely essential. And it is for that reason Swami says here also that, though I am going one more than the traditional, beautiful, wonderful, rounded number, I am doing it because this university is going to be like no other. I think in the same way, even in the countries of the world, Swami has emphasized many times that Bharat is like no other country, no other country is like Bharat. And if at all the world has to progress, it has to be with Bharat being the engine, pulling all the other countries which are like bogies. And Swami says that is the reason also why the avatar takes birth in Bharat. Because you need the engine driver in the engine, not in any of the other bogies. Once the engine is on track and running on time, the rest of the train also runs on time.
Right. And as you were saying, you know, this is not to bring down any country in that sense, because every country has its own value. When we were going through this Chinese New Year, I was thinking that is a culture which gives so much of importance and significance on filial piety, you know, the love that you show towards your parents. Mm. And if you really look at it, I mean, apart from acknowledging that God can come down in a human form, the other thing is that we're all souls that are traveling in different births. If you really look at it that way, see, if I am a person who needs that culturing that I should have love and devotion towards my parents, probably that is a culture where I'll be born in. The soul's training needs, that aspect has not been covered, or that aspect has to be strengthened. Probably you'll be born in that culture. Or maybe there are some other cultures where the love towards one's life companion is given a lot of importance. If you see Swami's discourses in the primary, whenever somebody asks about, you know, what has Swami said about marriage, you know, what is the, I mean, a couple of months back, someone had asked, can you collect quotes where Swami speaks about addressing a married couple? Invariably, Swami's advice to married couple is about giving up attachment. Mm. Because in this culture, to love or to be, to care for the other spouse is actually not something that you need to tell a person. That kind of comes along with the culture itself. But here you need to emphasize on don't get attached to that person. So in that sense, the soul, when it travels through many births, it probably is born in these different cultures to learn those different values. You know, we've heard even Swami speaking about the Western culture, where Swami was saying that the efficacy which they have, they're very, very particular about not hurting the other person, not belittling the other person.
Being polite.
Being very polite. So Swami would say that that's something that you all have to learn. You know, Swami was telling that to students. So which means that if the soul lacks that kind of a value,
culturing,
probably that culturing will be got by a birth in that family. So in that sense, I mean, looking at ourselves as beyond the body, there is nothing like a country or a region that does not matter at all. But Swami gives a lot of importance. I always think of it like this. You know, if I am proud to be an Indian, it's understood, right? Mm. Because we are all proud of wherever we are. We are proud of our parents, whoever they are. We are proud of our language. We have not chosen the language. But if Swami is proud of being Indian, there is something different to that. Because unlike any of us, I think it is a choice that Swami makes. And as Swami says here, it's not a one-time choice. It's a choice that he makes every time when he comes down in a human birth. He says, I want to be an Indian. So there is certainly value in that, but at the same time not belittling any of the other cultures.
Going ahead, Hislop then says, some persons visit a number of ashrams, and there is certainly a temptation to do this. And Swami responds, in America, there is so much restlessness that people grasp anything purported to be spiritual in order to find a little peace. But that peace is temporary. Spiritual organizations may have some value at the beginning level. They encourage the person to start inquiring for God. Inquiry is 3/4 and sadhana is 1/4. One has the right to inquire about a saint. How does he act? Why it is thus and thus? But going to many gurus is like a man who owns an acre of land. He digs a bit here, then moves over to a new spot and digs a little there and so on. Finally, he digs one hole which is deep and finds water. The total of all his diggings was perhaps 30 feet. At last, in one digging, he did find water. But his acre was spoiled by so many shallow holes dug here and there. Had he stayed with one hole and 30 feet, he would have had his sweet water. The acre is the spiritual heart. All the holes are different gurus. Now, the spiritual heart is ruined by so many holes. They are leaks. So, Swami strongly advises against seeking multiple gurus. He says, find your guru, have faith and dig deep enough. Wherever you dig, you find the same water. Don't make your spiritual heart into an agricultural field filled with holes. Dig at one place and dig deep. So I think this is so very, very important for us, because suddenly after the physical departure of Swami, especially those who have been in the physical presence of Swami, at least in my experience, that has been the case, that people who have had physical proximity of Swami seem to be desperate to find some other physical proximity to hold on to. You know, those who have come after 2011, you know, who have not had the physical proximity of Swami, possibly they find it easier to accept, because I love Swami, I know Swami, but I have never had a physical interaction with him, so it's fine now also. But those who have had, it looks like we have got addicted to it. Just like you said, in a marriage, it's advised that give up attachment. We are not ready to accept the attachment, accept the advice of giving up attachment to the physical frame. That dangerously leads us to seek. It's the same divinity in every person, and we want some feet to hold on to, some hand to caress, you know, some palm that will pat us on our back and encourage us. So for those of us who are making that mistake, treading that path because it feels easier to do it, rather than try to seek Swami in my heart and make him manifest before me, it's always easy to buy a ticket and travel to some place and, you know, go and meet an existing person. So Swami says that would be akin to digging extra holes in the spiritual heart. And when I say seeking others, I feel to an extent even waiting for Prema Sai, you know. When will Prema Sai come? Because I want to go and, you know, I want to get from Prema Sai what I didn't manage to get from Satya Sai. That is also another hole that we are digging. We've got Satya Sai. I love the way Professor G. Venkatraman answered a devotee when they asked this question about Prema Sai. They asked him, sir, what about Prema Sai? Because this was after the 2011. So everybody was in that sorrow and sir, Prema Sai. So everybody is looking up with hope to Prema Sai. So when he was asked that, he said, look here, in my life, I know only one Sai. And that Sai was filled with Prema. He is only Prema Sai. I felt that was such a beautiful reply. And I think, till we reach that level of Advaita, we need to have this loyalty, love towards one name and one form. Then only we will find that sweet water of fulfillment. Otherwise, we'll, as Swami says, we'll end up with holes.
Right, and what Swami said here initially, you know, it's like there is a lot of restlessness. I think that's the case. This conversation must have happened 40 years ago, but that's the case even now. There is always restlessness. And it's very easy to give that temporary peace, you know. In the modern age, I think we understand that. A simple app can give you that. Right? A simple app which gives you 4 instructions of how to calm your mind. It does give you peace. I mean, there is no denying that. Anybody who has used some of these apps which help you in meditation and mindfulness and breathing exercises, you don't need a person. Which means it is very easy to calm the mind and to give that temporary peace. And we find this in, you know, in the case with everybody. You know, different kinds of meditation techniques. I always say this when people ask about different meditation techniques. Say, if you give me 10 minutes, I will repeat the same sentences and you will find peace. It's got nothing to do with me. It is an exercise which if you do, you will find peace. Right? And that has got nothing to do with somebody being a guru, somebody being a spiritual guide, somebody being an avatar. And and that is one of the experiences of devotees who have come to Swami for many, many years. Peace is not something which is given so easily. Right? Mm. Peace is something probably like a bait that is given to you initially. But then Swami would say that don't expect this all the time. Right? One of the Westerners whose article I was reading quite some time back, I think Sanatan Sarthi, you know, the first time when they came to Swami, this was probably in the 70s, they said, we have never received so much love from a single individual. Swami was showering his love, and the very mere look at Swami would bring tears to our eyes, because like a mother he was treating us. Mm. He said the next trip when we came, it was completely opposite. Swami was so stern. Swami was so particular about discipline. Swami was saying, and he was saying that peace which was so obviously available, now it was not there. And he said it calls for a little bit of maturity to understand that spirituality is like this. That disciplining is important. It is not about simply, you know, putting yourself in places where you feel pleasant. Right? So Swami was, I think that is what Swami is referring to. Everybody has restlessness. And talking about those of us who are attached to the form, you know, in many ways we are also like Arjuna. Swami was saying that we believe that Swami is in our heart, but somehow we needed the Swami in front of us to even connect to the Swami in the heart.
Mm.
And we are going after, and for most of the people, especially people we know who are going to the others who claim to say that Swami is speaking through me, or I can see Swami, or I am Swami, and whatever it is, the modern, you know, problem with all youngsters, it's not only with youngsters, with all of us in the modern age, is what you refer to as FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out.
Mm.
I'm sure a lot of devotees are suffering from that. What if that is true? And if I miss out? And I think that is one of the fears that Swami attacked when Swami was in the physical presence. That here is a Swami, you can get him, nobody can take him away from you. And you don't need any other implement, you don't need an organization, you don't need an ashram. Sitting in the corner of the world, if you want him, you can get him.
That was pretty brutally brave of Swami to say that, right? Set up a huge organization, set up everything and then say, actually you don't need all this.
Right.
to say that, because as you said, Swami says that the Lord is available to one and all. And in fact, the word guru slipped out of my mouth because that is the next question and that is where it's going. It's very interesting. But before we go to that, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, continue with a visitor who asks this question from Swami. What is a guru then? Because right now Swami has ruled out all the gurus. So he asks, what is guru? And Swami's answer again is interesting and enlightening.
Shivaya, namah Shivaya, namah Shivaya, namah Shivaya, namah Shivaya, namah Shivaya, Samba Sada Shiva. Namah Shivaya, Samba Sada Shiva, Namah Shivaya, Samba Sada Shiva, Namah Shivaya, Girija Shankara, Namah Shivaya, Girija Shankara, Namah Shivaya, Girija Shankara, Namah Shivaya, Girija Shankara, Namah Shivaya, Bhavani Shankara, Namah Shivaya, Bhavani शंकर नमः शिवाय
back, dear listeners, as we hinted just before we went into that break, there is a visitor who asks Swami, what is a guru? And Swami replies, a guru is light to show one the road, but the destination is God. One is grateful to the guru, but it is God that one worships. Nowadays, one worships a guru, which is quite wrong. Now Hislop adds, suppose that guru is the Lord himself, how would that change the picture? And Swami laughs. He says, it changes the picture a great deal. If the Lord is one's guru, no need to worry about anything. Just as a loving mother cares for her child, if one has surrendered his life to God with full faith in him, the Lord takes care of that devotee. No need to worry about anything. Really, guru is only God. I mean, I think the tone is, really, guru is only God. God is within only. Those outside are not gurus. They are teachers of one sort or another. Guru means he who removes darkness. Only God can remove the darkness within. Only God's grace. So, Swami makes it clear that guru is one who shows the road. He's a teacher who helps you in the subject. But you understanding the subject and mastering the subject totally depends on your own ability, your effort. And it's an individual journey. That's why there'll be 100 students in a class and you'll have somebody getting 95% and somebody failing. How is it? If it was dependent on the guru, why is it if it's dependent on the teacher, why is it that somebody are coming out in flying colors and some are failing? Because yes, the teacher or the guru shows the path, makes it a little bit easier. But finally, you have to walk the path on your own, and it's your own internal understanding. So too, Swami is saying, the guru shows you the road, shows you the light, but remember that is not the sole goal. That is just the light by which you see to reach the final destination, which is God. And that God is within you. You have to achieve that connection.
Right. Swami would often quote this example. I think we've spoken about it of Dattatreya, where he says, you know, there are 24 gurus, and he would mention so many beings, right, from a honeybee to a fish and to a spider and all of these things. He'd say all of these are gurus. And Swami would often speak about that, and he would say that, you know, when the guru is actually, the role a guru plays is, it's a slight paradigm shift in the way we look at life and the way we look at what is the purpose for which we are in a human form. And Swami would say that that does not come naturally, in the sense, like, if you're not given that information, there is often, it is said that it is not a direct knowledge. Like Swami would say, some things are worldly knowledge. You know it. This is right. This is wrong. This food is
fire
good.
Fire is hot. Don't touch it.
Don't touch it. This food is bad. This is spoiled. This is, you know, these are very obvious knowledge to you.
Swami instincts.
Say, yes, and it is visible, and it is common knowledge, Swami would say. But to know that you are not the body, and to know that what is seen is unreal, or what is seen is a maya. So Swami would say that does not come as a natural knowledge to you. So that has to be given to you. And Swami would say that when a person's mind is good, when a person's mind is pure enough, it is God who sends down people who will give that information to you. It could be a book. It could be a person. That's why Swami would say that that Dattatreya episode is so important. Because Dattatreya represented that sadhaka who was ripe enough, who could, you know, learn from so many forms.
All around,
and say that all of these are my gurus. So Swami would say that it does not depend on who that person is. And I don't know whether you have come across that conversation already, or it comes later, where Hislop asked that question, what about if the guru is a fake? I think it has already come, I think, in one of the conversations. What about if a guru is fake? Swami would say it doesn't matter, because yes, it all depends on the Shraddha or the earnestness of the disciple. And again, going back to that example of, you know, digging a hole. So Swami places so much importance on the earnestness of the individual more than the person who is guiding. And that very beautiful Chinnakatha which Swami would say about a man who serves a guru for 12 years and the mantra which is
in
given,
reply for a mantra.
Right, and you know, there's a lady who takes it away, and then she writes it in a leaf and puts it in her earlobe. It's a long, this one. But the whole essence of that Chinnakatha is, at the end of it, Swami will say that, see, she had it for so many years. What did it do to her? She read it too.
And right? The interesting thing is, the way Swami concludes the story, Swami says that he opened the paper, he saw it, and then he got liberated. And you know what? At the end of the story, you're like, hey, what was that mantra, man? And then Swami gives a message that it doesn't matter what that mantra is. The yearning that you had gave power and potency to that mantra.
Right. And there's that very beautiful episode that I might not get the details right. Again, it was part of Sanatan Sarthi. And when we say Sanatan Sarthi, it is to tell our listeners that it's authentic, because as we had discussed some time back, it was Swami who would approve which articles would go. So I think in one of the articles it is there, this experience of Mr. Gadia, Dr. Gadia.
From the United Kingdom.
Right, the elder Gadia. The one whom we have often seen as the younger person.
Or the doctor who sings.
Right. Not sings. I think we had done the Miracles and Beyond on his life. Where in Uganda, he had that experience with the armed militants and all of that. So this was the elder brother of this Dr. Gadia, who's also Dr. Gadia. And I think he was in the interview room or Swami's room on the first flow when Swami was talking to him about all spiritual concepts and all that. And then he said, Swami, what is it? What does it feel like to be in that state where you don't see a person as being separate from you, where you're seeing everybody as God and seeing that oneness? He says, I wonder, what is that state? Now, how will it be if you're like that? And literally saying that, how are you leading your life? You know, it is to be Swami. It is to see the world from Swami's point of view. And then Swami was saying something. And he said, no, Swami, you should give me an experience. I'm not able to understand. You know, intellectually, I know. I've read a lot of books. But what is that experience? And then Swami tells him, oh, you want an experience of how it happens? Swami said, I'll tell you. And Swami whispers something into his ear. And then he has that experience, I think, which lasts for 3 days or a week or something like that, where he sees Swami everywhere. He sees Swami in himself and all of that. And that article says what exactly Swami told. Swami tells him Tattvamasi. Right? So, imagine that word, that statement is the mantra which gives him that experience.
It's available.
Right, it is there. We have heard it. I mean, you're hearing it even as I'm saying it. Or you might say that, no, you should hear it from the avatar's mouth. We have heard it even from the avatar's mouth.
Right? Discourses. We can put it in a loop and hear it 1,000 times a day.
Right. I mean, there is one beautiful discourse in 91 Samukos where Swami says this Tattvamasi. The discourse itself is about that. Swami says it at least 17, 18 times. Swami keeps saying Tattvamasi and then explains it. And then he says Tattvamasi. Like, we have heard it even from Swami. But why are we not having that experience? So the guru, what he does is only that, you know, when that mind is prepared and when that individual is ready, as Swami so beautifully says, it is a light. It is a light that shines. There is value to that. But then the value is only as much as it is able to lead you to that destination and nothing more than that.
In the modern day today, in the modern world today, there are many reasons possibly why people seek a guru, but I think it's predominantly two reasons. One is you are genuinely seeking God, you are yearning and you are striving, but you seem to have come to a kind of a stalemate. Nothing you do seems to be helping you to progress ahead. And we are a very, very impatient generation, impatient world now. Even when we download a simple game on the phone, 3 attempts, if you're not able to clear a level, we just go online and search for the solution because everything, not cheat codes, the solutions are presented.
Okay.
There are YouTube videos that present solutions of how to cross each stage, each level. We just want it simply because we are impatient. And you know, though I get the solution, I'm referring to the game, and later I'll refer to the other case also. Though I get the solution, what I lose out is that joy of discovery that gives you a kind of sense of fulfillment. That is gone simply because you got it ready-made. But because I'm so impatient, I don't mind even letting go of the joy of fulfillment in order to get the answer quick. Now, that is kind of paradoxical when we speak in the spiritual terms. As far as the video game is concerned, it's okay. But in spiritual terms, the goal of your spiritual quest is to find fulfillment. And we are ready to let go of that simply because we are impatient. No wonder Shirdi Baba said that you have Shraddha, which is intense faith, but you need Saburi along with that, perseverance as well. Because we are not able to persevere, we go see gurus and, you know, we hope that they will give a quick fix which will solve my problem and will put me at ease. And when I say quick fix, it's not just for materialistic or worldly problems. I love to see Swami. I want to see Swami. And need not be gurus. How many times we ourselves ask others, how is it? How can I, you know, connect to Swami? What should I do to get closer to Swami? That kind of yearning sometimes, the yearning is good, but because we are impatient, we go. The other reason is possibly because it's a kind of fad now, you know. It's a kind of a fashion thing. These fads come and go in sinusoidal waves. There was a time when there was that hippie movement, and so everybody went on to that. So possibly that's also a thing now, because if we see in the last decade, so many spiritual gurus and guides have literally mushroomed. That is what has happened. So it is also possibly because it's a fad. And as I said, there might be other reasons, but in my opinion, these are two predominant reasons why we, you know, follow a guru. You know, I follow a guru by doing nothing but just watching videos on YouTube, or, you know, it's not that it's an irreplaceable part of my life, or my day is not complete if I don't do something like this, or, you know, I won't be able to survive if I don't have, it's not like that. It's just another entertainment option, and I think that I'm following a guru by simply seeing a few videos. So that's why I said it's either a fashion or it's either impatience, in my opinion, for most of the time. What we have to realize is, in both these cases, seeking out an external guru like this becomes only a temporary solution. Because, again, it's like hunger, you know. If I want a permanent solution for my hunger, I need to learn how to cook. That's it. yes, today somebody may feed me, day after somebody else may feed me, but if I don't learn how to cook, I'm always at the mercy of somebody else. And that's why Swami is saying that don't do that. Find a permanent solution. Find a solution, finding which you'll not have to find any other solution again, which is learn how to cook. In this case, Swami is saying, discover God within you. That is the guru within you who will guide. And that should be the case every time, except when God himself becomes your guru. That's why Swami laughs and says, and laughs and tells Hislop that if you say that, what about if God is a guru? Then it changes everything. If God is a guru, then guru becomes God. But if God is not the guru, remember that guru is only an indicator, a director on the path. You still have to find the Lord within yourself.
If you look at it, in a sense, the modern generation, as you were saying, that many of the solutions to our problems are very easily available. Swami would say this in his discourses. He would say that hunger is a disease and food is a medicine. And a series of things he would say like that. So he would say that this is how it should be treated. Food should be treated as medicine and you should eat it like that. But Swami would say that, see, these are all the things that man has been striving for. There was a time when gathering food was such a difficult thing. So all your life was spent in gathering food. All your life was spent in just protecting yourself and your family, right? You're living in the wild. And they would say that the only way to protect yourself is to be aware and to be vigilant, right? So if you really look at it now, so many things are so easily available. In fact, the modern generation, there is no need to search. And if you want to know something, you want to know some facts, you want to learn something, it is so easily available. You know, everything you want to learn, an instrument, it's so easily available. You can go to YouTube. And at the same, in the same way, if you want to know some simple things which you know border in this spirituality and the realm of regular relationships and, you know, how do you control your anger, these are things which are not completely spiritual, but you don't need to be a spiritual person to need that. Everybody wants to know how to be a better leader. Everybody wants to know how to have better control over yourself, right? All of this is also easily available. You can go and it's the same techniques. It's the same thing which a spiritual person will say, which a personality development trainer will tell you, how to take a control over yourself. And in a way, if you look at it, all of these are so easily available that the mind looks for something more deeper much sooner than how it happened in the past. It took 40 years for somebody to find the grounding, and then, you know, 10 years of married life where you settle everything, and probably then you start thinking, okay, what is more in life? But now you are able to do that at the age of 20, 25. Your needs are satisfied so quickly. And when that happens, at least when it comes to this, when you're trying to seek something deeper, the problem is, you know, you cannot develop patience all of a sudden. That patience. So with the same, right, the same restlessness continues even in the spiritual quest. But if we are able to be, as Swami is saying here, be that calm and be that self-assured that I can find Swami on my own, I don't need any implements and I don't need any assistance, then I think this probably is the best time to be, where all your needs are satisfied so easily. And there's this one need which is left, where if you can focus all your patience on, and I think in that sense, it probably is the best time available.
Yes, it's worth the wait. In fact, when you said you want to develop patience instantly, there is a patience like that. It's called impatience. Going ahead, Hislop says, in this business of sadhana, very interesting the kind of words he uses, because that's what it has become. It's become a business of sadhana. He says, in this business of sadhana, why is it not possible from the very start to take the Lord as guru and surrender one's life to him? Again, Swami laughs. And Swami says, that is not so easy. Very difficult to do. First, one needs to tame the mind. It is just like a wild elephant in the forest. It must be caught and tamed. Once subdued and tamed, it is like an elephant in a circus which can be made to sit on a small stool by a small boy. That is the result of training and practice. So when Hislop says, why can't we start off only by surrendering our life and mind to God? Swami says that's not easy, because think of it, when we say you're surrendering in a war, when you surrender your kingdom in the ancient times, you're able to surrender a kingdom because that kingdom belongs to you, you're the king. A peasant in the kingdom can't go and tell that I'm surrendering the kingdom. You can't. Only what you have control over, what belongs to you, what you are a master of, that is something that you can surrender. So going by that definition, if I want to surrender my life and my mind to Swami, I must be the master of my mind. I must have absolute control over my mind. Same thing with life. I should be a master of my life and have control over my life. When I don't have control and mastery over my life and mind, that's why Swami laughs when it is asked, why can't we just start off by surrendering the mind to God?
And the simple answer to that is yes, if we could do that, there's nothing more than that required.
Hmm.
I mean, that's what it is to be patient, right? If you surrender it to Swami, then you're accepting his time frame, right?
Hmm.
If he feels that it has to happen in the next lifetime, it has to happen in the next lifetime. If we have that kind of patience, of course, we don't need anything at all. I think our problem is that we are desperate, we are restless, and in that desperateness and in that desperation, we are ready to take it from anybody. And I think that's where the problem lies. And the example which Swami would often give is that of, you know, a devotee like Dhruva. Swami would say it was not easy. Here is one boy who has said that I want something and I'll take it from the Lord himself.
Hmm.
Right? Because of an advice which his mother gives him, or in fact a stepmother gives him. And, you know, that's a perfect example of, as they say, if the right time has come, you will get the good advice even from the wrong people. Right? Because it's his mother, it's his stepmother who tries to put him away, saying that you cannot sit on your father's lap because you're not born to me. So the boy asks, so what should I do? What is the solution to this? So she says, go and ask Lord Hari. You know, he's the Lord of the universe, only he can give you. So it's advice she gives him to, you know, put him off.
Mm.
But the boy takes it so seriously because they say that soul is mature enough. The time had come where the guru is going to be God for that boy. So he goes away and Swami says that it was not difficult. 5 months, a 5-year-old boy going through that kind of a thing. Yes, if we have that kind of resilience and patience, then definitely that is the whole discussion here, that you don't need anybody else. The guru is within.
On that note, we'll take another quick little break, dear listeners. And there's one more question regarding the mind that a visitor asks. We'll continue with that. But that will come after this break.
Mahadeva Maheshwara Sai Narayana.
Dukha Bhanjana Sai Narayana.
Welcome back, dear listeners. After Hislop had asked Swami about why it's not possible to simply surrender one's mind and life, Swami says it's not so easy because the mind has to be under your control. Only when you master the mind can you be a mastermind. Only when you have control over it can you surrender it. Now a visitor asks, the problem of training the mind seems very difficult. Why not take the path of love? And Swami says, love also is not that easy. In the world, there can be too much love, which leads to unbalanced action. Indian culture manages wives by keeping them fully occupied in the house. But for the divine, love may be unlimited, no danger. Worldly love should have a limit. But love of God is unbounded. It has no limit. Lack of understanding is not too dangerous, but misunderstanding is very dangerous. In America, the movies, although bad, are taken for granted. In India, they corrupt and destroy respect for womanhood. So many points over here. But, if I have to pick one, I'll possibly pick the one where, in answer to the question as to why not take the path of love, because training the mind is very difficult. One thing that Swami is saying is, your understanding of love is totally different from what love is. If what is shown in the movies, you consider it as love, that's wrong. It's not. That kind of love, if it's unbounded, it can lead to problems. And Swami says, that kind of understanding of what love is very important before you embark on this journey of the path of love. Because, for example, Swami gives the example of movies in America, what is taken as normal and fine, it's taken for granted. Possibly because that's what you're accustomed to, When you see people hugging and kissing, public displays of affection, all those things, possibly you've grown up seeing it and it doesn't feel anything, doesn't cause much of a negative impact on you. But Swami says the same thing in India, they corrupt and destroy respect for womanhood. And this is being spoken in 1980s, and I think post 2000 we have seen that happening. We have seen that happening, and on one hand, when people say you're taking away our freedom to dress as we like, do as we want, Swami says it's different, This is not the way you have seen your women from childhood and birth. And therefore, when a sudden change is brought about, the reaction is bound to be different. You cannot expect the American or European kind of response when something that is typical to Europe and America is brought into India where it is not typical. That's why Swami is saying that. So, in short, as I said, Swami says, the path of love is great, but what you think is love is totally different from what the path of love is.
Right, and whenever Swami says the mind has to be trained, the training of the mind is important. The point that Swami would often make is, as you also just mentioned, it is about mastering the mind. And when you say it's mastering the mind always has inherent likes and dislikes. There's something that it finds interesting doing. There's something that it enjoys. But Swami would say that it is not about going with what the mind likes and dislikes. And the essence of the entire discourse on dharma which Swami speaks of, the Dharma Vaini, if you say, Swami would say that, you know, you keep something as a higher reference for you to follow than what the mind likes and dislikes. So Swami would say you have the buddhi tells you what is right and wrong, and that precedes what you like and dislike. And Swami would say, when Swami says here the, you know, what you talk of as love is totally different, if you really think it is not love, it is liking. You know, I like a person, I like doing this, I like spending time with such a person. It is not what love is, and that is only the same problem. Likes and dislikes is the problem of the mind. And you're again catering to that. You know, I like being with this person, I don't like doing this, I like spending my time like this. You are only further becoming a slave to the mind. So it is about going beyond that. And when Swami would say love, he would say that when you say love for God, or even when you say love for parents, it always comes with a little bit of sacrifice. You're ready to forego what you like doing for the person whom you love. And that is not emphasized in novels and movies when you portray love, or at least not emphasized enough.
And you know, when you say you make a kind of sacrifice for your mother and father, then only it is love. Even the love that exists between a child and the parent, or between siblings, Swami gives it a different name. You know, there is Vatsalyam, there is Sneham. That definitely has aspects of love, but that is not love, because by definition, Swami says love is absolute selflessness, when there is no selfishness at all. And that's why Swami says a mother's love is next to God's love, because possibly that comes closest to selflessness. But even there is some kind of selfish element in a brother's love, in any kind of love. So when we say that we take on to the path of love, it means being absolutely selfless. And that is so difficult, you know, when we think of it. One way of defining selflessness is about having no expectations. You know, when a mother brings up the child, yes, she does it absolutely selflessly. But at a very subtle level, there is that desire that my child should grow well, my child should be disciplined, my child should be good. There is some sort of an expectation from the child. In the same way, you know, when we talk of friendships, or when we talk of between a brother and a sister, or any other kind of relationship, the expectation keeps growing. It's very, very intense. A lot of expectation. I did this. And in fact, you know, these expectations come to the fore when you have an argument or a fight. I did this for you. You can't do that much for me. I mean, it's almost like a transaction. You start doing transactional analysis. This is what I did for you. This is what you have done for me. So it becomes like that. And when that is there, it clearly is not love, because love is selflessness. Swami says love is selflessness, self is lovelessness. Which means the moment even the slightest bit of selfishness comes in, there is no love at all. Because self is lovelessness. And the moment you want to love, there has to be absolute selflessness. Which means absolutely no expectations at all. And you continue to love the person irrespective of whether he or she is fulfilling your expectations. So with that perspective, when we view, we realize that possibly, you know, mind control is easier than
right. No, I think Swami is also attacking at the idea that I can do away with mind control and love is enough. Right? If you look at Swami's discourses, I mean, any number of times Swami says love is most important. Love is most important, and I think most of the discourses Swami concludes by saying nothing is more important than love. And then Swami would, you know, end with prema mudita manasi kaho, because that would be the essence of any spiritual discourse. But that doesn't take away the importance of mind control. I think the way Swami has set up the ashram, the organization, that is one thing which Swami has emphasized, that even for love you need discipline. Swami would say there should be discipline also. There is that beautiful interaction which we had mentioned even a couple of weeks ago, where Swami says, you know, to be a man you should have manners. Manners unte man, Swami said.
Behavior unte boy.
Behavior unte boy. And then Swami said, discipline unte devotee. We might tend to think that devotion unte devotee. You know, if you have devotion, then you're a devotee. But Swami said, no, if you want to be called a devotee, you should have discipline. Which means there is a discipline and there is a dharma which is attached even to love. And the question probably came from a point where, you know, why do we need to, you know, all the sadhana and all that? Love is enough. Yes, love is the most important thing, but even that needs a little bit of training of the mind, as you say, as you rightly said. Only when you have a certain control, you can even obey Swami. No, I love Swami so much and I want to do whatever Swami says, but how can I do it if I have no control over my body and my mind?
You know, on that note, I think, you know, Prem, this is a perfect time because tomorrow happens to be Shivaratri. And innumerable number of times Swami says in his discourse that the mind has 16 kalas or 14 kalas. Mm-hmm. And it's in sync with the moon. And tomorrow happens to be the final day where the last bit is left, you know, the last aspect of mind is left. And this happens on a monthly basis. That's why every month we have a Shivaratri. Tomorrow happens to be the Mahashivaratri, which is a very, very special night. And Swami says that efforts that you put in on this day to control the mind and master the mind will have much more effect and much more benefit. That is why Swami would say that this is the night when the moon is in its last phase. Possibly it will be just a thin crescent. After this, it will be a full moon. It will be a new moon night. Absolutely, it will be gone. That is symbolic of the mind's impact or mind's effect being totally wiped clean. That's why Swami would encourage and enthuse us to, as much as possible, stay awake whole night doing bhajans. And again, here the emphasis would be on doing bhajans to go closer to God, to achieve proximity, nearness and dearness to God. Not about just keeping awake whole night. In fact, Swami would also say, don't spend the night playing games and watching television or reading some novels or playing cards, Swami would say. that doesn't mean that you have kept the vigil on Mahashivratri night. But Swami would often say that, but Swami would definitely emphasize that if you manage to keep the vigil on Mahashivratri night, you will go a long way in being able to control your mind, gaining mastery over your mind. So dear listeners, tomorrow will be Shivratri and Mahashivratri and the night long bhajans will be there. May we participate in that wholeheartedly and grow in our control of our mind. All this because our final objective is to go closer to Swami, be dear to His heart and grow in our love towards Bhagwan.
And dear listeners, to let you know that as always, we will be broadcasting live the programs that happen in the Mandir. But tomorrow being Mahashivratri and you have the night-long bhajans, we will have the live broadcast as long as the mics are on in the Mandir. That's what we always do because that's a prerequisite for us to go live. So as long as the mics are on, probably that's around till 8 or 8.30, you will have the live broadcast of the bhajans from the Mandir. Before that, you will have the Abhishekam to the Lingam, which Swami had established during the Atirudram. Those programs will be there. But if you wish to continue from your homes, the bhajans, there are a lot of devotees in especially Singapore, China, Hong Kong and all of these countries where the governments have cancelled public gatherings. So I think a lot of Mahashivratri celebrations have been cancelled. Staying at your home, at the comforts of your home, if you want to tune into bhajans, you can listen to bhajans from 8 in the evening till 5 in the morning when the live resumes through our bhajan channel. You will have bhajans being streamed constantly for that entire period, all Shiva bhajans. Or if you want, you can always tune to Asia Stream to listen to bhajans. These are our little ways to help you stay connected. And as Arvind said, to use this opportunity, as Swami said, every opportunity for a sadhaka. I mean, if you're a businessman, how vigilant you will be for an opportunity where you can make money. Swami would say for a spiritual aspirant, that's how vigilant you have to be for every opportunity you have to go closer to the Lord. And Mahashivratri, Swami says, is one such golden opportunity when we can turn this mind towards God. And this is our little effort in trying to help you in that. With that, dear listeners, we'll conclude with this bhajan, on the other side of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu for the program Love to Love. We'll join you all again next week for resuming this conversations with Bhagwan. And on behalf of all of us here, a very happy and holy Shivratri to each one of you.
पाहि महेशा हे जगदीशा पाहि महेशा। महेशा हे जगदीशा।